Following program is paid for by the Cadillac Foundation.
It's time for Cadillac On Call on News Radio 610 KONA. It's your chance to learn valuable health information right here in our community. Now, the host of Cadillac On Call, here's Jim Hall.
Hi, friends. Welcome to Cadillac On Call, presented by the Foundations at Cadillac. Each week, we are here to share with you health and medical information that you might find useful. We feature subject matter experts from Cadillac and other healthcare agencies in our community. That is our aim tonight, as we will let you know about new surgical technology at Cadillac that will expand access to certain types of treatments. And we will connect with local public health colleagues to offer important health and safety information just in time for the first holiday weekend of the summer season. First, it is known in the operating room circles as the Da Vinci, and it's the brand name of robotic surgical technology used by surgeons at Cadillac. A collaborative community fundraising effort among the Cadillac Foundation and the Tri-Cities Cancer Center Foundation secured the nearly $2 million, entirely $2 million, to purchase the Da Vinci surgical robot, and it will soon be put into use in the operating rooms at Cadillac Regional Medical Center. And our first guest today is Ann Erke. She's a nurse by training and the operating room manager at Cadillac Regional Medical Center. And first, Ann, thanks for taking the time to be with us today. Why don't you begin by giving us a brief overview of how this robotic surgery technology works?
Hi, Jim. Thanks for having me. So with the Da Vinci robot, it's really cool, actually. It has four arms that come off the main robot unit. Those arms rotate in a 360-degree manner, which is controlled by a physician console that's not attached to the robot. It's off to the side, but in proximity to the patient. The physician console has this 3D technology that the surgeon can utilize to manipulate those robotic arms. It allows them to see really deep into the abdomen, into deeper cavities that they otherwise would have to make a long incision to do so.
So they're using this the digital technology or the robotic technology to be able to assist them with the surgery. Is that the concept?
Yeah, those four arms do the work, and they're controlling those arms through that console.
I know Cadillac has had this technology for a number of years now, and how will adding this particular robot, an additional robot, improve patient care, in essence, serve more patients?
You know, right now, our access has just been limited due to the amount of procedures that we already have scheduled and the number of providers trying to take care of our patients. So with the new robot, we really can reach more of our population in our community. I really think it's going to make a great difference.
And what types of surgeries are we talking about? I know there are many, many different kinds of surgeons and obviously surgical procedures that are done, but what kinds of surgical cases are we talking about?
So our specialties that currently use the robot are our colorectal surgeons, our urology surgeons, we have a general surgeon, and our GYNs. And really the procedures we're doing are, we have a lot of cancer-related surgeries, again, related to colon cancer, renal cancer, and any gynecological cancers that we have.
And so I would assume then that having additional capabilities with this technology, it allows more of these types of patients, and we know we're in a growing community, and we know the challenge of all of the people that want to utilize Cadillac services. So will this be a great relief in that respect?
Yeah, this is going to really help us get more patients through. We see a lot of patients already, and just the ability to help our community and those patients going through these tough times and needing these surgeries.
Let's go back to the actual surgical technology itself. I know it has been around for a number of years, and obviously this version is the latest, I'm sure, in that version of types of robotic technology. But what are the true benefits of this? Versus the old traditional ways of how these surgeries have been done historically?
So historically, you know, these procedures would need a long incision, and when you have a larger incision, it takes longer to heal. You might have a longer hospital stay. So by using these robotic arms to get into those tight spaces, it really makes it a less invasive procedure for our patients, and a smaller incision really helping in shorter healing period versus that really large incision that we used to have to make.
And I know the latest round of equipment has arrived and the training has begun, but because this type of surgery has been done at Cadillac for a number of years, does that mean the ramp-up time is lessened just because most of the surgeons and the staff are familiar with this type of equipment?
Absolutely. You know, we're not, right now, it's the same surgeons that use the robot currently will be using the new one as well. And so our goal is to just increase the amount of patients we can take care of in a timely manner. And so we're looking forward to being able to do that.
And probably one that people might be interested in, maybe just a summary of the number of operating rooms that you utilize at Cadillac on a general basis. And will this equipment, is it a case where you move it from room to room based, or will it stay in one particular room where these surgeons will come and utilize it in that particular space?
Yeah, right now we have 12 ORs in the main OR at Cadillac, and the robot sits in the same room. So we'll have two rooms that have the robot in it moving forward. Right now we just have the one until we get the other one implemented. And, you know, it's just with the console and the robot, and we have extra equipment and towers that we need for these procedures. It's just best to leave it in one room, so we're not driving it all over the place.
And if you wouldn't, maybe on a general basis, you touched on there's 12 operating rooms at Cadillac, and I think the community very well knows with the growth of the Tri-Cities that Cadillac is trying to grow with it. Give us an idea of how busy the operating rooms that you touched on are at Cadillac.
Well, just in the last 12 months, we've done about 10,000 surgeries, and of those, 750 of those have been robotic cases. So just being able to increase that, I mean, we already impact a lot of our community now, but this will just help us help more and more of the community members that we have.
And if you would, I know whether it's the robotic surgery or some of these 10,000 surgeries, the vast majority, I'm sure, are within the Tri-Cities zip codes, but maybe speak to a little bit from your view that you see patients coming from a much larger geographic region, do you not? Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, being a regional medical center, you know, we get patients that come from Eastern Oregon, Prosser, even some from Yakima, I mean, just all over because, you know, our reach to the community is so large. We're the, you know, largest hospital around compared to Sacred Heart is in Spokane and Swedish on the west side. I mean, OHSU is kind of down in Oregon there. So we see a vast majority of patients from all over, plus the Tri-Cities.
We touched on at the beginning of the program that this technology, this Da Vinci, as it's called, is funded essentially all through community contributions through our two foundations, the Cadillac Foundation and the Tri-Cities Cancer Center Foundation. As a Cadillac caregiver, an employee who works and manages people in the operating room, maybe a comment, if you would, about what it means to you to have this kind of equipment and this technology and know that it's being funded by probably the patients who might receive care with it.
Absolutely. I've been at Cadillac for 15 years, and I know that the foundation has played such an impactful role at Cadillac in many areas, and really I am in awe of the donors. It's truly a gift that will help our community, you know, for years to come, and we can't thank those donors enough for their support, you know, not just for Cadillac, but as you said, it's our patients we're taking care of, and our patients are sometimes our donors, so it really touches so many people, and we're just so appreciative of the support.
And I can't let you go without talking about the amazing staff that you have in the operating rooms. We spent many a night consecutively talking about COVID during the pandemic, talking about how the healthcare system is trying to grapple with this. Maybe just a shout out to your teams and post-COVID and where we are. You say 10,000 surgeries in a year. That's incredible. Very busy place.
Yeah, absolutely. We are so, so busy right now. You know, as we're ramping up to get the second robot into action, I want to just shout out to our robotics team. right now, and then all of our OR caregivers, our anesthesiologists, and our surgeons that we get to work with every day. You know, we get to provide these wonderful tools, but they are the ones learning how to care for our patients utilizing these pieces of equipment like the robot we have. And I just, they work really hard, and I can't do my job without them, and just so many people to thank in the process.
Well, Ann, all the best to you and your team at Catholic Regional Medical Center. This new technology is exciting, and I'm sure it gives you more equipment and more capability to serve more patients. Ann Erke is the operating room manager at Catholic. Back with more of our program right after this.
You're listening to Cadillac On Call on 610 KONA. This program provides general information only. Any comments or information presented are strictly for educational purposes. Cadillac and 610 KONA do not endorse any of the suggestions made by the presenter or callers. Now back to Cadillac On Call. Once again, Jim Hall.
Welcome back to Cadillac On Call, presented by the Foundations at Cadillac. Now, coming out of the pandemic, one of the most pressing issues that we all faced was in the area of mental health. The significant increase in behavioral health challenges also raised the awareness of the importance of addressing it and eliminating the stigma associated with it. We want to spend a few moments tonight with a public health expert to gain some more insight on some of the key indicators we need to be aware of regarding our mental health. And I'd like to welcome Kelly Harnish, the Healthy Living Program Manager with the Benton Franklin Health District. And Kelly, I guess, is as devastating as COVID has been in so many ways in the behavioral health sphere. You know, perhaps the increased attention hopefully has brought more attention to all of us being aware of our mental health.
I would say that's true. Thanks, Jim. I would say, you know, there was definitely more focus on the concept of isolation and what that can do for our mental health. And there's definitely been more attention nationally and locally here on, you know, really emphasizing our community mental health and our behavioral health resources.
And with that, certainly, what did you find at the health district that was the most concerning, I guess, as a overall aggregate relative to what happened with mental health and the concerns? Was it the isolation?
It's very well possible that the isolation has something to do with some of the concerns that we've seen. In 2022, we completed our community health needs assessment in a partnership with Cadillac, and we found for our youth, we're really seeing youth struggling with mental health, really focused on the fact that 1 in 5 youth in our area have seriously contemplated suicide. So that indicates an increase, especially in our older high school aged students in their suffering mental health. And then we also did observe in that same needs assessment process an increase in suicide rates for our older population. Our 65 and older adult population actually had the highest rates of suicide in our two counties, which is alarming, and may speak to some of the issues around isolation that happened during the COVID pandemic, and kind of continue to, you know, this day when we see that a lot of our time spent with people may be online versus in person, and so there's that you know, disconnect socially that can happen and really affect people's mental health.
And you touched on this community health needs assessment that is done, I believe, every 3 years. And I know mental health is, even before the pandemic, if my memory serves, even the prior health needs assessments, mental health continues to be a pressing issue in our community, does it not?
Absolutely. Yes, it was a priority area in the 2019 needs assessment, community health improvement plan. And it is, again, another priority out of 4 of our priority areas. It's a very big one for this next cycle of needs, and our focus is on the community. It's both a need for, you know, prevention and resilience in our community, but also on the response. We need definitely to move upstream as much as we possibly can to really strengthen our social connections, and that can happen through policies. It can happen really through community-level investments. It can happen in families, at homes. It can happen in schools. And it can even happen in clinical settings through, you know, good screenings of patients. And so that's all kind of that upstream prevention. But we also are really seeing a really big need for more providers. So we're seeing also that response need where there's just a shortage of people available to help those who have reached crisis or would like to, you know, see a regular therapist on a regular basis and get into a good cycle that way.
And one of the challenges, I'm sure, is, and it's all across the healthcare spectrum, is that you just don't produce new doctors, nurses, therapists, all of these people that have this expertise just overnight. It takes time, and so you try to do the best you can to mitigate it in the meantime?
Absolutely, yes. So some of our initial ideas are to work with higher education to look at certificate programs or other, you know, lower barrier options for students to be able to enter the field and provide some relief to the need. And then obviously, you know, really in a big picture, looking at how behavioral health providers are reimbursed is another way that we can help enable people to enter the field and want to help as well. But definitely it's a long-term problem with long-term solutions, I would say.
And again, it's a lot of it has to do with policy, and unfortunately, it all many times just boils down to the dollars required to do it. But I know, you know, just from a symbolic standpoint and a resolution of a recognition standpoint, our community is seemingly wanting to embrace this. And I know at even a national level, there's some pretty alarming recommendations coming about with some of these topics you've just addressed.
Absolutely. You're right. From a national level, the Surgeon General earlier this month released an advisory on the epidemic of loneliness and isolation. But with this advisory, it comes with a lot of, you know, really good recommendations on what we can do on a community level. You know, we're not talking one person at a time. Obviously, that doesn't get us to really turning these numbers around and getting people to a healthy state, but really looking at community-wide initiatives. And the Surgeon General outlined six pillars to address this, and they address everything from our social infrastructure and where we can gather and how safe those environments are, to public policies, as you said, to the healthcare sector and how our mental health really impacts our physical health, and really just cultivating connection and looking at our, you know, digital versus in-person relationships. And so that advisory comes with a lot of potential strengths and investments, both, you know, nationally and then coming down to local level. And on the local level, the Benton Franklin Board of Health just approved a resolution this week that proclaims May as Mental Health Month in our area. So that also comes with the acknowledgement that everyone who lives here, it's our responsibility as a community to take care of the mental health of our peers and our neighbors and so forth.
And I know our community, our healthcare community, has really embraced this national campaign of 988, similar to 911, that it's a number that people can call if they're in a mental health crisis, which is an awesome partnership of the healthcare agencies in the community. But I guess I would just have a concluding question for you, Kelly, if you would. Until we can increase the number of providers and the access for people to access mental health, is the important thing perhaps maybe just, you know, good old, hey, check on your neighbors, check on your friends. If you have concerns of friends and neighbors or people like that, just, you know, reach out to them.
Absolutely. You know, we've all had hard days, and you know, it feels good when somebody acknowledges and reaches out. You can't always solve other people's problems for them, but knowing that, you know, that you're not alone and having somebody check in really goes a long way. And so it's kind of getting back to our roots as humans, as social creatures, of checking in on each other and then having that 988 resource available in times of crisis, whether they be mental health crisis or a drug crisis or thoughts of suicide. That is a resource that can get somebody, you know, immediate access to trained counselors to really help them and help them figure out what to do next and how to, you know, get through that until they are at a place where they can think about kind of the bigger picture things. And one thing I wanted to acknowledge in our community is just the real drive to reach out and make those connections. We have a behavioral health committee that's made up of many community partners, and they spend the entire month of May every year doing a lot of mental health awareness. So they've just been busy stomping the ground including tomorrow night. They'll be at Live at 5 doing mental health awareness, and they've been doing a lot of social media posts and radio spots, and so they've just been really busy trying to create awareness and make sure people have resources.
Kelly Harnish with the Benton Franklin Health District. Wonderful partnerships available. And if you're at home, go to the health district's website, bfhd.wa.gov. I know there are tremendous resources in this space. And again, if you're in a serious situation, that 988 is out there if needed. Back with more of our program right after this.
You're listening to Cadillac on Call on 610 KONA. This program is not a substitute for direct consultation with your own healthcare provider. Always consult your healthcare provider for your specific condition, especially if you have or suspect you may have a medical problem. Now back to Cadillac on Call. Here again, Jim Hall.
Welcome back to Cadillac on Call, presented by the Foundations at Cadillac. And tonight we're focusing on some preventive measures as we get ready to enter the summer season. And our thanks again to Kelly Harnish with the Health District, talking about the importance of addressing our mental health and taking care of ourselves in that respect. And we've seen already a bout of warm weather here in our community. And I understand, as I look at my phone and see the latest weather forecast, that it's going to be nice weather for the next week or so. But I do see the temperature is expected to inch its way back up into the 90s here by early next week. And so we thought it would be a great time to focus on some of these hot weather tips. And who better to do that with than Heather Hill, a longtime partner in this program, deputy health officer now with the Benton Franklin Health District, and probably most known to you as a longtime public health nurse and expert in this field here in the Tri-Cities area. And so, Heather, you know, I just touched on it, the beautiful weather tonight and this evening, and I know it's going to be throughout the weekend, but maybe just a comment from a nursing perspective of what we all need to be aware of as we get ready to enjoy the summer.
You bet, Jim. We are so lucky to live in a community like this with wonderful weather, but we're also heading into the season where that hot weather can unfortunately become deadly. And that's what we really want people to be aware of and to prevent those terrible outcomes. First, I think it's important to know that, you know, 50 to 70% of your body is water. Every tissue, every cell, your joints require water to be their healthiest. And so that's why we focus so much on hydrate, 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 especially when the weather turns warm. Our cars don't function very well when the radiator overheats, and that's exactly what happens to the human body when it starts to dehydrate, starts to get too hot. Our body organs don't function very well. So it's important to look at the activities we're doing, when we're doing them. If you know it's going to be a hot day, get those outdoor activities done early. If you're a gardener, if you're a hiker, a jogger, a biker, get those done early in the cool of the morning before it gets hot and things start to get dangerous. We need to think really seriously about all those workers that are out in the fields during the heat of the day, out doing construction at the heat of the day. Make sure that they're hydrating and taking the time to cool down if they need to. Heat stroke is an extremely serious situation that can happen, you know, unfortunately, as the temperatures start going up. And those heat stroke and heat exhaustion are the two areas that we need to be aware of. And oftentimes it's the buddy system. Whether you're out there jogging, whether you're out there gardening or working in the heat, make sure you're keeping an eye on those around you. Just like in the cold weather, we tell people to watch out for each other. We're going to tell you the exact same thing in the hot weather. Just see how they're doing. Are they making sense? Are they getting confused? When a person is going into heat exhaustion, their body is overheating, but it's still compensating. But it is a warning to you that things could go bad very quick and move into heat stroke. And when you hit heat stroke, that is when 911 needs to be called, because that can actually turn out to be deadly. Oftentimes, heat stroke, the person isn't even sweating. And people look at them and go, well, they're dry, they weren't sweating. That's because their body ran out of water to sweat, and they're not able to cool themselves down. Also remember that there are certain people who are going to be more prone to problems with heat. the very young, our babies. We don't want to bundle them up. It's hot outside. They can get hot, too. The very elderly, their bodies struggle with heat and cold regulation anyways. So keep an eye on those two populations. And it's probably a good idea to think, you know, maybe just staying indoors if it's going to be a hot day, and drinking lots of fluid. So what kind of fluids you could drink? Of course, water is your absolute best choice. But stay away from alcohol. Alcohol is actually dehydrating. A cool beer may feel like it's going to cool you down, but in the long run, it's going to cause more dehydration, and it's not going to help you like a good glass of water would be. Sports drinks oftentimes are high salt, high sugar, not the healthiest for you, so avoid those as well. So read your labels when you're looking at whatever drinks you're choosing and see what that sugar content is particularly.
I was going to say, the temperature's, I mean, very pleasant right now. And even if they get up into the low 90s, that's not unusual for our area. But even those temperatures at this time of the year, since it's kind of that first heat wave, even those temperatures in, say, the mid-80s, upper 80s, low 90s, it can also be areas of concern if we're not careful.
It definitely can be areas of concern because we haven't acclimated to it. It's that early season. Our bodies haven't had time to really adjust to that hotter temperatures that we're having, and we need to acclimate a bit to it. So if you were going to go out at 90 degrees in the middle of the day and decide you're going to run 5 miles for the first time in the year, that's probably the wrong choice to make. Your body is not used to that. So again, pacing yourself, getting used to the temperature, easing into the summer, and getting back into the cool of the house if you absolutely you can get out of the sun, get out of the heat. If you're feeling ill, you've got to get indoors and plan ahead where those cooling sites could be. If you're out and about town, get into a store, go into the mall, go into the library, a public building where there's air conditioning. Make sure you know where to get in. Just like getting in out of the cold, you want to find a heated place in the summer. Where can you go and cool down?
A couple of other things before we let you go. I know that are on this topic, but you know, the importance of avoiding utilizing sunscreen to avoid sunburn. But then the other thing that I know always is there that we don't necessarily realize is cars get very hot very quickly too.
Right, and every year we hear those tragic stories about children who fall asleep and the parents forgot them. We get distracted. A lot is going on in our lives. So use maybe a teddy bear you put in the child's car seat. And when you put the child in the car seat, you bring the teddy bear to the front seat. That's your reminder. Don't forget your baby in the back seat. And it's not only our children that we worry about. It's those pets. It's those dogs. Just because you roll the window down does not mean you're going to get enough airflow that it's not going to heat up. It will become lethally hot to both, unfortunately, children and your pets that you would leave in the car.
One final question before you go. I know you've always advocated, you want people to enjoy themselves, especially when it's 80 degrees, 85 degrees, enjoy all that we have to offer in this community outdoors. But at the same time, use your head and be smart about it.
Absolutely. We know that being outdoors is really good for our mental health. Having just listened to Kelly talk about mental health, being outdoors is proven to help our mental health. But we need to be cautious, especially when we head into these very hot summer months.
Heather Hill with the Benton Franklin Health District. Hey, Heather, I didn't ask you one COVID question for the first time in probably 3 years, so that's a milestone.
Pretty amazing.
Thanks so much for taking the time. Heather Hill with the Benton Franklin Health District. And again, the Health District's website has a wealth of valuable information on this topic we just addressed and many others, bfhd.wa.gov. One final segment, and back with that right after this.
You're listening to Cadillac on Call on 610 KONA. This program provides general information only. Any comments or information presented are strictly for educational purposes. Cadillac and 610 KONA do not endorse any of the suggestions made by the presenter or callers. Now back to Cadillac on Call. Once again, Jim Hall.
Welcome back to Cadillac on Call, presented by the Foundations at Cadillac. And again, a reminder, if you missed any part of our program, Cadillac on Call is available via podcast. Just search Cadillac on Call wherever you listen to your favorite podcast. We are focusing our attention on getting safely ready for a wonderful summer and a lead up to the Memorial Day weekend, the first holiday weekend of the season. And we are focusing tonight on some interesting public health topics. And one we want to address before we leave the air tonight is the water safety component. And knowing that a lot of people will be enjoying the water, whether it's on the rivers that are flowing their way through our community or in backyard pools, we thought it'd be great to bring Sierra Knutson, who's emergency response coordinator with the health district in Benton and Franklin counties. And Sierra, in your role as that coordinating emergency response, is that one of the primary concerns and focuses of you as we enter this time of the year?
You know, Jim, that's a good question. It's not really specifically to my role. Part of our job in public health is to really educate and communicate. But in the event of like a large event that would have potentially a lot of people in the water that were in danger, we would be part of that response system. So it's more kind of getting ahead of that and educating people about why they should be careful when in the water in the pool.
And I was going to say, on that particular scenario that you just addressed, people are out in a boat, you know, in boats and things of that nature, particularly with the weather predicted to be quite nice over the next several days. And so that could be, you know, whether it's boat accidents or people in a large boat that might capsize. I know the rivers can be very inviting, but they can also be very tricky to navigate and to deal with, right?
Absolutely. This time of year, the Yakima and Columbia rivers, they're both running really high and really fast. That's largely attributed to the snowmelt coming off the mountains. And it also means roughly right now, when I checked the temperature log this morning, that they're running about 50 degrees. And the reason that's a concern is that it can be really warm out. Kids are wanting to jump in the water, an inner tube. But what can actually happen is that when individuals get in that level of cold water and they don't have a life vest on, they can actually have hypothermia in about 9 minutes and then potentially looking at death pretty rapidly after that. And often what happens is that when people get in the water, their friends, you know, the people they're on their boats with, they don't necessarily know they're in trouble until they're really in trouble. So it's really important that they're mindful of the conditions when they're going out to boat.
And I was going to say, you said 50 degrees currently. Maybe what would it be in, say, early August, mid-60s potentially? Or you know the
about difference? 60s, about early, maybe the like very high 60s, maybe 70s. It doesn't really get that much warmer, but it is a critical difference of when hypothermia sets on.
And another concern, I'm guessing, has to be with the current that you touched on. There's pretty, you know, that not only is it cold, but these rivers are flowing pretty rapidly currently, aren't they, with the current?
You would be surprised at how fast people can get sucked down river. I actually saw an experience like that a couple years ago where I had teenagers out in the boat, one of them jumped off, and they were downstream so fast that it was amazing how fast the boat had to go down to get a hold of them. It is shocking, I think, when we don't really think about it on a day-to-day basis.
So what's your advice from your expertise in the emergency response realm for people as they get ready to go travel, whether it's to the mountains or to the ocean or somewhere that, or if they're going to stick around here and enjoy what we have to offer in our area?
There's a lot of different, you know, ocean, like you said, river. If you're going up to like kind of the mountains, it's really important to be aware of your surroundings, kind of checking into look at temperatures, weather conditions. The weather can change really rapidly, which can potentially change kind of what the river and the ocean front looks like. It's really critical, and I can't say this enough, that people wear their life vests. I know it seems kind of old-fashioned, but that is really the major difference between people who survive and people who drown. It's really, really critical for children who are small that they have swimming lessons, that they have parents who keep an eye on them at all times. And it's also important, too, that they have a Coast Guard-approved life vest on, and those are usually brightly colored, and they also have a strap that goes between their legs. And what's really important about those is that they fit snugly, kind of like a car seat harness, so that it's tight enough but not too tight for them.
And with this, we touched on navigating yourselves in the rivers around our region, but what about the backyard pools? Obviously, that's another very popular way for people to stay cool and enjoy the summertime. What about the advice relative for folks using backyard pools?
That's a good question. Pools, I think, are really common in the Tri-Cities. Kind of one of the statistics that always kind of comes to my mind is that, you know, drowning is the second leading cause of death for children 1 to 14, and ages 1 to 4, the most common drowning is in swimming pools. So what we talk about is having that multi-layered protection, and what that means is that you've got a a substantial gate around the pool that the kids can't get into. You might have a pool covering that is ratcheted down that they can't open. I have friends who have additional locks on their back doors that the kids can't reach in the event that they try and get outside. And also really ensuring that, you know, when they're outside, that you're monitoring them at all times. You don't ever take your eyes off of them. They can drown in about 2 minutes. So it's important. It's important to keep on them because they can be pretty sneaky at times.
And are there some, you touched on the importance of never leaving sight of them. I know there's some different techniques that, say, if you're having a backyard function around your pool and maybe just, what are they, taking turns as the adults, making sure somebody's got their eyes on the pool the entire time?
Absolutely. That's actually a good point, is that we kind of, in our family, call it the kids person. We take an hour rotation shifts. It's a very clear designation of you're on next. I'm relieving myself of duty so that there's never, kids are never unsupervised at any point in time. And it also prevents from that general, oh, I thought so-and-so had an eye on them. It's always Joe has got the person for the next hour. So there's that level of acknowledgement and ownership as well.
Hey, we just have a few seconds left, but I'd like to maybe have you just tie it all up from whether it's water or others, but getting ready, the weather's going to continue to be very nice, pleasant. It's going to get a little warmer progressively. But maybe just a concluding comment from your view of public health and emergency response of what we should all adhere to in the next several weeks.
You know, a couple minutes preparedness will save you and your family a profound amount of heartache and grief. You know, make sure to check your weather conditions, your lake and oceanic conditions. Make sure to pack your life vests. And, you know, don't hesitate to get CPR certified. You can find that at local American Red Crosses all over the Tri-Cities.
Sierra Knutson, our emergency response expert with the Benton Franklin Health District. Thanks so much for your always timely advice and very useful advice that we can all adhere to as we get ready to enjoy the holiday weekend. Thanks to all our guests, and thank you. Have a wonderful weekend, and we'll talk again next week.